Okay, I think it's time to start. We're a few minutes late, but that's not a problem, I think. My name is Jörgen. I work as the product manager for another Czech project at .se, MailCheck. We've been running DNS Check for a couple of years. MailCheck just started before the summer, actually. So this is a much more immature project so far. It creates, as we think, long-term value for the internet by doing this type of test exactly in the same manner as Bredbandskollen and DNS Check and some other open source projects that we are running. And it also provides data for the Health Check project. When we started to think about MailCheck, we realized that there is a lot of services out there that is testing mail servers. Many of them, though, just test for open relay and vulnerability to spam. MailCheck has a little bit broader focus. We also like to do things, as with DNS Check, to educate and inform people about how their email servers are doing. And that's everything from standard compliance, checking for older and bad versions of softwares, to testing different types of configuration and additional standards that add value to email, like SPF, DKIM, and TLS, for example. But of course, also this spam open relay problems that we can see. Exactly as with DNS Check, it should be useful both for the non-technical and the technical audience. And whoa, look, it looks almost the same. So we actually use exactly the same framework to sort of save resources. Simple tests, you can type in your email address and the existing version gives you back some information on how this mail server performs in exactly the same way as DNS Check. The advanced data also. Oh, that one was readable, this one is not. Let's do like this, just to give you a... no, it's a picture. Let's skip that back. But when you saw Einar's slide, you can see that this data from the advanced tab is providing much more details into the results of the program. This is also exactly the same as for DNS Check. There are a lot of ways of doing things, and what is a warning, what is an error, what is an acceptable way of doing things, what is unacceptable. This is something that we think have to mature over time, because in some cases, we won't reach consensus, because some people say it should be done this way, some others say it should be done that way. So we simply have to inform people that this is done in this way. There is other ways to do it if you want to. This is the pros, this is the cons in different ways. And just try to give a overall picture. Is this mail server working? Is it performing the way it should be? We have actually just a couple of days ago opened this website. We call it a public beta. We are on this URL, which actually can be read. And what we have now is a basic set of tests. It's good enough to be useful, but more functions will be added over time, and how we evaluate the results will be perhaps changed over time based on experience. We are also trying to inform on this website about this technical framework that we're using and the possibilities for each and every one to be a part of this project and come with ideas or even write code, as this is a modular system. Exactly as with DNS Check, it's written in Perl and in the sort of testing framework, and the display framework is already there, so that's... We haven't released the source code right yet, but it will be sooner or later, I hope, and preferably on the same license as DNS Check.
Would there be any reason not to?
No. Just want the code to be sort of...
working.
Yeah. Testing is both for the individual user. You want to know how your server is doing. We also want to see how is the general email on the internet, perhaps in Sweden, doing. Because email is a very important infrastructure. I mean, can you register a Facebook account today if you don't have an email address? I'm not sure about that, but most services require email in some way. So testing is for the user to get a view of his server, it's for us to get statistics, and we can also do this educational part based on the statistics. Right now we have the website, also readable, where you can actually test MailCheck, and you can report bugs, and you can also come with suggestions and hints on things that you like to see in the tests. There's also a mail list, so it can be found on this URL, where you can actually subscribe to the mail list and be a part of the team discussing MailCheck. That doesn't mean that you have to be a developer or that you're actually going to contribute, but it could be interesting just to be there and monitor what people are thinking and how the discussion is brought forward. Questions?
I have tried the service, and one of the things that, I mean, I remember ordb.org that mostly tested for OpenRelay, they had a policy sort of that you can only test from the IP that they're coming from, you know, so yep. You're not testing somebody else's stuff and for vulnerabilities or whatever. How have you thought in that area?
We have thought a lot about security and attack vector vulnerabilities of this tool. First of all, we have a, shall we call it a rate limiter, that can limit the number of tests per email address or per domain over time. And that can be set fairly low, and that means that you're not able to do very much testing on specific servers. We're also talking about doing checks on source IP, so that a single user who is testing cannot go around doing tests like this. But the interesting thing is that if you want to do large volume scanning for vulnerabilities, this is not a good tool because it's GUI-based. And there is much more useful tools out on the network that you can download to your computer. So we don't think this will sort of catch the attention of spammers. It's much too complicated to use for them.
Yes. Might think that you are doing something that they don't want, policy-based or...
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, I mean, of course, it's new, though, so yep. You haven't get the feedback yet, but I guess one of the things that might come out of this is that, you know, why are you scanning my server,
yep.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. And we have started to talk to, for example, different blacklists companies to inform them about this service, what kind of security it has built in, why it's there and who we are, and in this way trying to establish some sort of whitelisting for this service, because we think it will in the end bring more useful information to the society than harm, and we think they will sort of appreciate that too.
I appreciate it.
Okay, good. Any more questions? Matt? Yes.
Would
I think that we have to fine-tune this tool so that the administrator in some way can decide on his domain. Right now it's very, crowd tool. It blocks a domain based on one user's feedback. So I blocked iis.se just to check, and I got the feedback from Patrick sort of 2 seconds later. Who did that?
Nope.
Yep. Right now that's the case.
When I got the other part of this, the backend part demonstrated by Amri the other day, the first idea that I actually thought of, so all the different thing is to having some integration with the momentum here, the domain handler. So if you are a registered person there, like protect the contact or something like that, then it gives you some extra things for all the different. More than enough to see, mm-hmm. You could actually do this blocking, non-blocking, and those things.
Yep.
That would be sort of a natural thing to do, in my opinion.
Definitely a good
this
idea.
This is also, of course, something that evolves and develops and things yep. like that, and that might be something that comes in the long run.
Yeah, it's a very good idea.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that will only work for those who has .scs registrar.
Yes.
Because the main manager is only available for.
Yeah. And what we have done is we've said very clearly that this tool is not for testing Telia's or Tele2's or Comhem servers, because I think they can manage that themselves. This is more for small companies, medium-sized companies, or your personal web mail server. So initially we have also blocked the larger ISP's mail services because it's not useful to test them from 1,000 users. Giving the same result over and over.
The big thing there, I think, is it has to be very clear on the page
yep.
why. So you don't have to get all these hints for hats and say, you are in some conspiracy with these guys because they're sucking and you don't want to show it. It has to be really clear that, okay, you
that's
have
true.
The results, we're not going to do it again,
yep.
go away.
Yep, very good idea. Alex, are you making notes?
Yeah.
You had a question?
Yeah, maybe you could, do it once and then just have this pre-rendered result.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. We've been talking about that. So we have sort of one test per week or something. That's always shown if you test Telia, for example. That sort of takes away some of the tin hats. Next.
But then you could, if you change the server of the test, how could you say that I want to do a new test? If it's a week renewal and you want to renew in an hour, maybe. Would that be a little bit?
I'm not sure. Alex?
You mean for blocked?
No, if you have this, I only want to be tested once a week. If you change something, how do you check?
Ah, okay.
You're
right.
The admin of that server, and you want to do those
yep.
changes you need.
Yeah.
yeah. We have talked about another sort of feature that could be used. I'm not sure how we can implement it, but to send out some sort of key to either system admin or something that he can use to sort of override things. And that could also be used when blocking domains so that we get a little bit more control. So, yes, I want to block my domain, you enter an email address. That address must be sort of the postmaster or hostmaster or something in the domain handler, for example. And then this key is sent to the system, and only the one with the key can block. So it could be something that we can manage in that context. Aina? Okay. That's also a very smart idea to have. Okay, more questions?
How does this work with Gradius Day? Thinking about caching and related things like that. You will not get rid of the results if someone has created.
No, there is a lot of things that we cannot do in real time. So in the first sort of public beta we are presenting right now, we only do tests that are done within a reasonable amount of time. Then you have things like gray listing tests, and you have performance tests, things that might actually be better to do offline, so that you start the test, the system completes the test and sends you an email with a URL, this is your results, now you can go and check for the results. And in that way you can test gray listing, for example. So then the tests will be divided into interactive tests and sort of batch testing. And still you want to keep this interaction.
Yeah.
You want to have a tool that actually gives you something immediately, because otherwise people lose interest. So, yeah, it's a tricky.
But I guess it depends on what the target users are for this. I mean, it might not be I'm sitting on ADSL or something, it might be more that I have just set up a new mail system. I want to know that this is sort of secure or...
I haven't forgot anything.
Yeah.
We hope so. And as I said, we started development just before this summer, so I guess it will take quite some time before we have something that is more sort of fine-tuned, that actually produces what users want. More questions? Seems not. Next speaker.
Hi everyone, my name is David and I work at a website monitoring company called Pingdom. And I've been asked to come here today to speak a little about website performance and also how to monitor the uptime of your website. So basically I'm just going to give you an overview of what you can do, why you should do it, and I'll also dive into some a little more technical details and give some tips that's really easy to do on how you can increase the performance of your website. First of all, errors. I guess this is something that you all know. It's something that we see all the time. And sometimes they're, you know, longer, and sometimes they just happen occasionally. So, and this is why it's important to monitor, because maybe they are only visible for some users. And then we have the other interesting aspect, and this is actually the performance part, where you go to a website, but it takes really long to actually receive the web page. And this is getting more common now also when you have using more Ajax things that also increase the performance time. So why should you actually monitor your website and work with performance? Well, of course you want to increase the traffic to your website, and this is, you know, by always having a site that's available, you can increase the traffic to your website, and also increase the number of sales or leads or whatever action that you want your users to perform on the website. And then you can decrease the bounce rate, and this is the actual number of visitors that leaves your site because they're not getting what they wanted in the right time. And another important thing is to benchmark your speed, and this is actually to run tests on your website and then do the same for your competitors, so you can compare these results, because you always want to be as good as your competitors, if not better. And then another good thing is to gather statistics. By constantly monitoring your website, you can actually gather a lot of data. And from this data, you can read out lots of results. For example, do you have any performance issues from certain parts of the world? and things like that. And it's only possible if you're constantly monitoring your data, so you can see if it changes over time. And the other thing that you want to do is actually keep track of your, if you're outsourcing your hosting, or if you're using any external providers that you rely on your website. Perhaps you have a payment system that you know, needs to be working all the time. You want to monitor those. And most of these services actually have a service license agreement. And the only way you can know that they're actually delivering according to this promise is to measure. So you can give them, you know, this is the facts, you're not delivering according to your promise. And then, of course, you want to avoid negative press and buzz. We all know that as soon as a website goes down today, people start talking. And this happens instantly. So if you just go to, for example, Twitter, you can see that people start talking the moment it goes down. So not only do you want your technical people to start working on the issue, you want to get your marketing people to actually inform your user on what's happening. So, some statistics. According to research by Camelus Research Partners, they saw that website downtime only for European countries costs over 5 billion euro every year. And this is actually lost sales and pure badwill that companies are getting by not having a working website. And then related to performance, Google has done a lot of interesting research, and they saw that if their website became 500 milliseconds slower, this would actually mean a 20% drop in traffic on their website. And you can imagine what this would mean for Google, and it's less than a second. Amazon did some similar research, and they saw that if their website became 100 milliseconds slower, they would actually lose 1% of all their sales. And then the content delivery network Akamai did a survey where they saw that 47% of all web users expects a website to load within 2 seconds. And they did the same research in 2006. And the result is that the expectations are twice as high today. So expectations from users are really high. And then we have Yahoo. And Yahoo is working really hard with the performance things. They have lots of great tools and have done lots of great research, which they are actually sharing on their website. And they found one really interesting thing. And this is that the front end, or actually everything that happens in your web browser, stands for 80 to 90% of the total load time of a typical website. So this is actually where you can do most of your improvement and where you should start. And the good thing is that it's also where it's most easy to do changes. So this is just a basic overview of the client side or front end, which is actually your web browser, all the files that are loaded by the browser and then put together to form the actual website. And then you have the server side backend, which is all your servers that are needed for your website. So if we're going to focus on the front end side, there's a really great tool that Yahoo has built called Wiseflow. And the thing Wiseflow does is actually to measure and grade your website performance. And it does this by, they have actually produced 34 different best practices on what you should do to increase the performance of your website. So the tool is built as a Firefox extension, so you have to have Firefox and then install this tool. So it will not only do all this test, but it will also give you some actual tips on what you can do to improve the performance. So this is something that you can download at developer.yahoo.com. So I wanted to give you some tips on how you can improve the performance of your website. So I picked out a few tips from Wiseflow that are really easy to do, or at least most of them. And the two important parts when working with website performance is the smaller the website, the less information you have to transfer. So this is basic. This will, of course, increase the speed of your website. And then we have another really important thing, and this is the number of requests that is required to render your website. So the fewer requests that you do, the faster your website will render. And the number of requests is actually the number of files or objects that's loaded with the website. So these are all your images, the JavaScripts, the CSS files. Because each of these requests adds overhead. So you want to have as few requests as possible. So on to the actual tips. First of all, compress your images. And most people think, well, I'm already compressing my images because I have Photoshop or something, and I use the Save for Web option. But actually, there are much better tools that does this and can compress it even more. So for example, in Wiseload, they've integrated a tool called Smushit. And the thing you can do is actually just load up your website, open Wiseload, and press a button. And the thing it does is actually to load all the images from the website, recompress them as much as it can, and give you a neat package that you can just upload to your web server. And then you're done. So I did a test, for example, on Aftonbladet.se, which is one of Sweden's larger newspapers. And just by clicking that button, I managed to reduce the size of all images by 7.5%. So that was almost 100 kilobytes. And another thing related to compression also is to use gzip. And gzip is actually a technique that you enable on your web server. And the thing it does is that it will actually compress all the files that are sent from the web server to the browser. So it will just do this automatically for you. And just by doing this, you can improve the performance by about 15 to 25%. And another thing that you can do is to minify your CSS and JavaScript files. And this is actually to just remove all unnecessary white space, unnecessary characters, or any comments that are in them. So instead of having the nice human-readable format that we're used to working with, you just smash everything together to get the most compact files. And there are several tools available that does this for you. It can do it both on the server side, and also you can do it manually when you create your website. So in this image, I used the online tool with the CSS from Aftonbladet once again, and I ran their CSS file and managed to squeeze it down by 15%. And then we have another thing to reduce the number of requests that you need for your website. And this is to use CSS sprites. And CSS sprites is, instead of creating lots of small images that you use on your website, you instead create bigger images where you put lots of images into one. So you can see the example here from Amazon on how they're using lots of different elements which they put into one file. So then you actually use CSS to just select the parts that you want to display on the website. And the bad thing with CSS Sprite is that it's manual work. It can't be done automatically, but it will give a huge performance improvement if you do it. And then we have another tip. This is to combine your CSS and JavaScript files. So instead of having, if you have a website, it's really common to have several different CSS and JavaScript files. And the thing you can do is actually combine all of these files into one file instead. And this is to, again, save the number of requests. And a common thing is, for example, to use the jQuery framework for your JavaScript. And usually you use that framework, but then you start to add more plugins. You want to have this and you want to have that. And in the end, you will have lots of files. So then you want to instead squeeze them all into one file. And this is also something that can be done automatically on your server. Or you can do it manually when you create your website. So that was my few tips that I had to actually improve the speed of your website. And if we instead look at the back end of your site, which is actually all your servers and the software you're running or and the networks that are required, you can monitor these in two different ways. And this is internal monitoring and external monitoring. And internal monitoring is basically when you install a software inside your network, which can connect to all your servers and pull out all the important data that you need to actually check the system health. For example, you want to check your database servers on how many queries are they actually running and keep track of when this starts to increase so you can add more servers or actually increase the performance of the server. And then you can also have lots of other values that are important to just your web application or website. For example, in Pingdom, we monitor lots of internal factors in our system just to keep track on where the bottlenecks are and when we need to upgrade hardware, for example. And there are lots of softwares available that can do this for you. And some examples are for Nagios, Cenos, and Hyperic. And all of these are actually free open source softwares. Only Cenos and Hyperic also have commercial enterprise versions. And then we have the external monitoring. And this is actually what we do at Pingdom. And this is to, instead of monitoring all the servers and get critical data from the inside, you have lots of servers that are geographically spread around the world in different places, and you do perform all the checks from these locations. So this is more like your regular web visitors that are spread around the globe. So you can actually not only see how it was working in the inside, but you will also get the aspect of the actual network path on the way to your website. So this is a really great way to monitor downtime where you can actually see how it's working from different locations. And the good thing is by having all these different servers around the world, you can also see the actual load time or response time from different locations. So for example, if you can, for example, see if your website is getting slower only from the US because of some things related to the network or routing. So, to summarize quickly, I think you should, if you want to dive into this a little more, I think you should really install YSlow. Because it cannot only give you a lot of good data, but it can also give you lots of good tips since it has all this information included in the package. And if you want even more performance tips, I suggest that you get the books by Steve Saunders, and he's actually the guy that created YSlow from the beginning. So he's seen as the guru of all things that are website performance related. And if you're not already doing it, you should, of course, start to monitor your website for downtime. And here we have lots of great services available on the net, and one of them is us at Pingdom. And if you just want to try it, we actually have a free account where you can just test one website. So this is a really simple way to get started to actually test the uptime of your website. So that was all that I had. And thanks for listening. Any questions? More?
More. But it's a simple question.
Where?
Do you mean the up there? Do you mean server side? Don't you? It's server side, essentially. Client side. Or is it client side?
On this slide?
Yeah. On all of them. Because all these optimizations stuff seems to be on the server side.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, it's related to how much you actually transfer to the front end. So they're seen as front end improvements. But yeah, you're right that the actual thing that you do is on the server.
Okay, so yeah, I mean like that.
Yeah.
The second question, you had a slide with something that Yahoo had tested, like in quite early in the beginning.
The voice low? Yeah.
When you say front end stands for 89% of the load time.
Yeah.
Are you actually sure that this is the actual load time for the site and not stuff like DNS queries and stuff that takes time to get to the site?
Well, you know, DNS, if you consider the total time you wait for a website to load,
yeah.
DNS is really tiny. If you think of all the things that you need to actually transfer to your web browser and then to render it.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I think it's actually the DNS part. This is quite a bit more than that. Unless it's a very intensive site like that, a blog, for example. But if you go to Google, I think the DNS queries is more than the actual loading on the site. So what I mean is if Yahoo has just started the clock when you type the URL, and then they consider that it took 90% of the time to load the first page. Then
yeah.
If you click on a link, it takes 10% of the time to go there. Then it's basically, I think it's mostly because of DNS and stuff like that.
Their research, which I can't back up because it's their research shows that when you actually type in the URL and you start to load the website, it's the time from you start loading it till it's actually rendered on the page, you know, everything is completed. And in most cases, this can take, let's say it's 1 second to actually display the whole website.
Yeah.
And then the DNS part will be just a tiny fraction of the total time.
It could be.
But of course there are exceptions. Yeah, for DNS. Unfortunately, I don't have anything with me, but it's for sure something that we can look into.
I will jump in here, and I think that what Yahoo means when they say front end is they mean everything that has to do with sending data to from the server to the client, whether it's DNS queries, it's HTML data, and what they talk about, what they mean back end is actual work done on the server, such as database queries, Apache loading, and all the things that happens after the request reaches the web server. So probably what they mean, 80-90% is everything combined. DNS overhead, lookup times, transfer to from the server. And usually what happens is when somebody sees a website that is slow, they will start looking in the wrong place, which is the database must be slow, or the Apache probably needs more memory, or the server is too slow, we need to upgrade the server. Whereas, in fact, it's usually, like you can see here, 89% of the time it takes, it's just shuffling data back and from the server. And that's where you can do your quick fixes and gain the most time.
Yeah, this...
It gets a little confusing sometimes in web because talking about front-end and client usually means everything that happens between the server and the client, not necessarily the client itself.
Yeah.
Back-end usually you mean server technology, Apache, databases or other web servers for that matter, and not the classical client server.
You're exactly right. And one thing that, for example, adds to this in my example is the number of requests that you use for your website. So if you have a really intensive website that loads 100 images, the overhead of loading those images, of course, includes the DNS part.
Yeah, but the point is, I think, unless they exactly specify it, but, as you did now, it's extremely unfair because it's like comparing pinging localhost and pinging server out there. I mean, they compare the time it takes to transfer data from one location to another geographically and transferring data locally on the server. I mean, of course, it's quite a bit faster to work with yourself than with someone else.
Yeah, but then, you know, then you should have this in the back of your mind to start to work with this part, which is kind of their point. So
I think what happened was in the 90s when we started working with web, we had to work very, very, very hard to make our websites super fast because everybody was on a slow dial-up modem, and it was suicide to have a website that had more than, say, 40 or 50 kilobytes that they had to load. And then everybody got broadband, and we got lazy, and we started putting everything on the website and not really caring about how many images we loaded, how big they are. People, like we could see here, it's not even necessary to compress your images to the max anymore, which used to be almost a science back in the day to get your, to shave just those few extra bytes off your GIFs. And now nobody really cares anymore. And what you can see is that using old school web technology, like making sure you have far futures expires headers in your server, and make sure that images and CSS files and the JavaScript files and other files that are not necessarily changed between page loads, make sure those are actually cached in the browser, can save a lot of time because you don't have to make that extra round trip to the server every time you load a page. And nowadays, with dynamic websites, that's not necessarily true. Most sites, especially checking with YSlow, which is a really good tool, you can see that every time you load a page on the site, the client is going to ask the server, oh, hey, I have this CSS file from the last time. Is this still good? Do I need to check it again? Oh, yeah, it's still good. Here you go. And all that extra round-tripping adds up when you have maybe 50 or 60 requests to make the page. Now, if you use technology that used to be used on static websites in the 90s, and you make sure that you tell the client that, okay, here's your CSS. You don't need to ask me for this again for another week. And then making sure that the client doesn't ask for it again also saves a lot of time.
Yeah. And the thing that's happened, if we look on the history of website performance, is, like you said, during the 90s, everyone was focusing on, you know, broadband penetration. The delay was in the networks. So the focus was totally there. And then we came to the, you know, beginning of 2000, maybe. It started changing. Then everyone was talking about the server side. You know, there came lots of new solutions for databases and how you should improve the performance on your servers. But if you look at the web and the discussions that are now, everyone is talking about the front end and how to improve the performance there. You know, Google is launching a new browser that's only mainly focused on speed. I think it's the front end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what are the top 10 optimization things that you can do? Is that the pictures that you can bundle to one?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that you can do. I just picked out a few that I think can make a huge impact. And that are
go back to that YSlow screenshot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can talk about this picture. if you can read it.
Really
this picture shows what's going to happen when you come into a web page as a completely fresh browser. You've never seen this page before. These are all the elements you have to load. There are images, there are JavaScript files, there are CSS, there's HTML, there's maybe other things. And this, what YSlow tells you here, is if you have a perfect optimized site, then the first time you come there, obviously you have to load all these files. The next time you come there, even if it's 30 seconds later, you really only have to load the HTML document, the actual content, because everything else most likely will be the same. It'll be the same logo on top of the site. It'll be the same JavaScript files. It'll be the same style sheets. And if your cache settings are correct, this is what it looks like. One request, which is usually very, very quick to make because it's all text.
Yeah.
And this is not very common to see. This looks very good.
Yeah.
But if you go to a lot of major websites, this does not look like that. It looks like maybe you have 53 requests on your first page and then maybe 33 requests, whereof maybe at least 30 of those are completely unnecessary on the second page.
And the reason it looks good is, I think this example is actually google.com.
Yeah. It could also have been IIS.se.
I guess one of the major problems today in the dynamic web sites are, you know, the remote inclusion of files from everywhere. Your partners suck because they have a bad
Google Analytics. And yeah.
That's a problem also. I think if you have a big dynamic site, you have to work with your partners so they don't sit in a bad line or a bad server or bad performance. That can really screw them.
Yeah. There are a lot of new services that actually rely on you including their code into your website.
I think the general trend is that you have more and more external resources that have to be loaded that you really depend on for the page to run.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, there are also benefits of maybe choosing to load your jQuery from Google or from another content delivery network because of streamlining requests. Whereas you can only usually make two simultaneous requests to each server, loading files from many places on the web could be quicker. But it all, of course, depends on that partner having speedy and nice web servers.
Yeah, and like you said, Google has this actually where they offer you to include JavaScripts that are commonly used from them. And the thing that also happens then, if a lot of people are using them, the chance is that the visitor actually has them cached already. So he doesn't need to download them at all.
Yeah. Cache in general, I think, used to be the most important thing. And when I was a web developer in the 90s, this was something we fought against. And we even started including headers in the page saying, oh, don't cache. We want to make sure that everything is updated all the time. Because back then, it was a hassle. You updated a picture on a website, and how many times did you have to tell everybody in your organization, oh, empty the browser cache, and you'll see the changes. So we started doing all this work to make sure that images were loaded dynamically, like throwing random queries at an image to make sure, oh, it's going to be different every time. And so we started working against the cache, and now I think it's time to take a step back and see, oh, yeah, maybe that caching wasn't such a bad idea after all.
Exactly.
Because now when you have, like you saw Aftonbladet.se, the largest website in Sweden, has over 1 megabyte of data to download for each page if you don't have a cache. I don't know how much of that is ads, and those are probably not cached anyway.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions?
I have a completely different question. If you have like a Drupal site consisting of a lot of PHP files that's all included in one file that's rendered HTML, do you have any tools to detect which PHP file that are using up the CPU cycles on the server?
Which of the included files?
Exactly. If you can like have a model of PHP that logs each executed PHP file execution file.
Sorry, I'm sure there are such a tool available, but you know, I'm more of a front end kind of guy, so unfortunately I don't have any answer.
Does anybody out here know the answer? I mean I work in PHP myself and I have not seen such a tool. Usually I am writing that tool myself when I need it, and PHP does have excellent backtracing functions where you can see each function, and you can also make a callback to time each function if you want to. But I don't know of a ready-made tool that does that. There might be one out there, though.
Yeah.
So you run a backtrace manually, like not like...
No, just adding a timer in your code to start a timer each time you call a function and stop the timer and then log those.
But then you manually have to add that to each PHP file.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You look like you're looking for a debugger.
Yeah.
Would really great.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got that question before now.
Yeah. And I guess this is the common way to do it. For example, I guess in WordPress they have this by default where they print the time it takes to actually render the page on the server.
Yeah, that's how I ended up.
Yeah.
Before.
But that's a complete time, and if you end up with a slow site, you have no idea.
Yeah,
which
so
of
then
these
you have to split
pages,
it up.
Which of the 200 files was the culprit?
Yeah.
And yeah, this is a problem, and web development is still kind of behind in a lot of ways. It's easier usually to go in and hack your solution to try to time, but if you're only looking for a profiler or a ready-made debugger, I encourage you to start writing one and then spread the word. Any other questions?
Yep. I think this is a common problem because most of them are actually designers, so they don't care that much about the technical part. So, and I think this is why it looks like it does in many places where the websites actually are slow, because they don't know or care how it actually works on the behind the scenes.
It's a bit like the Vista syndrome. I mean, you get things that circulate in 3G and it's whiz-bang cool, but people hate it. And it's really not really compatible with editing. And then, in the end, when people haven't adopted it, the almost go out and say, it's because of the security. We have made it too secure, we made it the wrong decision on security, and it leaked something else than it actually was. You can run it on all the different platforms and things like that you would like, because it doesn't support your sound part, mother making those decisions, making it looking cool, but doesn't render in Opera or Firefox or what have you. It runs slowly and has bugs and...
Yeah. But in this case, you can actually, you know, take the original concept from the web designer and just, you know, add these things that are Wiselow tells you, and you will get the exactly same page, but it will load faster.
But that's also, I mean, standard way that you have a good sysadmin keeping up with the developers in all the other places. If you have like a database or an house or a big corporation, having good sysadmin, they're doing that. Like
yeah.
Some developer doesn't know what ports they're actually using to talk between server and client side. Some sysadmin guy needs to do reverse engineering and try to find out and make some final rules or try to fix lores to actually drop the privileges and things like that because so really what we need to do is to go back to the source and try to fix that source, not to try to fix the symptom.
Yeah.
This is a good thing to try to fix the situation.
Yeah.
But to really solve a problem, we have to take one more step.
Yeah.
I think one step could be a bit more proactive and actually making a load test of the site before you publish it and try to detect things.
People do that, yeah. Or to buy your product for a cheaper
money. Well, there are cheaper services like, for example, we are providing.
I think the web developing business and web business in general is still maturing. It's a type of development that is about 15 years old. And I think what happened was most web designers or most web developers were designers that started dabbling in HTML, whereas most developers thought that HTML was too sissy to work with at all, and a lot of them still have that attitude that it's not a real PHP is not a real programming language, and you know HTML is, you know, for girls or for people who don't know what they're doing. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I'm just kidding.
No people
but
are Twitter.
I think the market and the developers are maturing, and when I talk to people who are web developers at large web agencies now, more and more of them are, if not actual techies, then at least they are aware of side of things. And we are seeing, because websites are becoming more important for businesses, whereas 15 years ago, they were something that a CEO could ask his 15-year-old nephew to hack together over a weekend and put up. Now it's actually core, and it's branding, it's very important. We are seeing more money being put into it, and we're seeing more serious side. But I also think that making risk-bearing websites is what drives evolution on the web. And also, if we didn't do that, if we didn't have all these websites that take forever to load and kind of pushes the envelope, we'd still be seeing the web in black and white. And for some of us, for some of you, that might be a better way of remembering the web like it was in 1994. But I prefer the web like it is now, and I think we're definitely heading in the right direction.
But isn't the solution getting back to some of the things that you actually pointed to before? I mean, everyone today needs to have a business case to anything. If you just come and say, this will be better, this will be false, this will not be black and white, they can just come to throw it out, unless you actually come with some figures to say, this
yeah.
is better.
Yeah.
So if you say that you will lose X percent of your customer because they're losing interest,
exactly.
you're doing, because you're too slow, you're doing this too much, blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
then you get their attention.
And the, I think the mobile
yeah.
development is really helping us there, because now people are having slower connections again, which means that it makes sense to look at why and to optimize yourself.
Yeah.
And also I think the browser wars that we don't anymore have one browser, now we have several browsers out there, is also helping. 6 years ago, you couldn't tell a client that we have to make sure that this website works in every browser, because they would look at their statistics and say, well, 97% of our users use Internet Explorer, why should we spend 50,000 kroner more to make it compliant with other browsers? Now, not so much. I mean, Internet Explorer is still the biggest giant out there, but it's starting to be important to make good websites for the Mac and make good websites for Firefox and other.
Two comments. I mean, it is really nice to have good-looking websites, but if the bells and whistles really hit the threshold of usability and also on some trust, I mean, if I get a flashing, flash animation on a tax authority website, I start being suspicious of it. It's really trustworthy. If I'm going to file my tax return, I need to have a proper form and it doesn't have to have all the problems with it. Second comment is, I was really surprised when I was participating last part of the year to develop a web-based system for voluntary rescue service communications coordination in Finland. And that's pure HTML. And that it runs on everything. You can run it on every mobile phone browser. You can run it and it runs on all the GPRS connections blazingly fast. And you can run the server in a laptop in the middle of nowhere in the forest where you couldn't use it during the search. Everything doesn't have to be flashy.
No.
But I'll have to add there that the bells and whistles, and I'm not talking about Flash here, but JavaScript and other things, because you did talk about the usability, and this has actually improved the usability for users. You know, using the right techniques, you can build a website that's more easy to use than it was. If you look at the website 10 years ago, they were really hard to use compared to today, where we can actually validate form data in a clear way before, without reloading the page and things like this. So somehow I think the bells and whistles are an improvement that we should use, but in the right way.
And I would have to, in a way, also disagree with you, because I think for a lot of users out there, it's quite the opposite. If they come to a web page that looked like it was made in 1997, they don't think. No, we probably agree, but I'm just, in general, there are, the technical view is usually that the less design, the better it is. I'm all for minimizing and making things run fast and making them look, you know, plain, and especially if you do, like, if you have a tax authority, obviously I want my website to look serious. But at the same time, I think users have gone over, crossed over into where they think
and the trends in design has, you know, in the latest year, everything has been more simplified. You know, in the 90s, you got really, you know, the page was packed with information, whereas most pages today, you actually have learned about this and exclude a lot of information just to make it, you know, it's not only faster to load, but you focus on the information that's really important and try to break it down into separate pages.
Okay, so, thank you.
Thank you.